Thank you for tuning in to the Israel Podcast, Episode 8. This is the fourth episode in a series on the Dreyfus Affair. In the last episode, we left off when Captain Alfred Dreyfus was arriving back in France after 5-year exile on Devil's Island, a small rock off the coast of French Guiana in South America. His case was reopened. He was scheduled to be retried for high treason. Most of the research for this series of episodes is from the great book by Michael Burns, Dreyfus, A Family Affair. I will leave a link in the show notes. All right, let's get into it. On July 3rd, 1899, 2 days after he set foot on French soil, Alfred Dreyfus gets a visit by his old lawyer Demange in his prison cell in the French city of Rennes. Dreyfus spent almost 5 years on Devil's Island, completely isolated from the world, and he had a lot of catching up to do in preparation for his court appearance. Demange, with another lawyer retained by the family, Fernand Laborie, begin a month-long private tutorial with Dreyfus as their student. They outline the chronology of his case, and they introduce Dreyfus to all the players and the legal and political intrigues that by now have turned a military court-martial into an affair. Mathieu, his brother, also joined them, and they found a prisoner that is mentally and physically exhausted, but also calm and extraordinarily confident. In those series of tutorials, Dreyfus finally learned of the key moment that had come 2 summers earlier, when both Mathieu and Senator Scherer Kestner independently identified the real traitor and the author of the bordereau. Marie-Charles Ferdinand Walezin Esterhazy, born in Paris, was the illegitimate descendant of a Hungarian family of diplomats, soldiers, and princes with huge land holdings in the Holy Roman Empire. But by the late 1860s, when Esterhazy joined the French army, there was nothing much left of the family wealth. Esterhazy would later make sure there was nothing much left of the family name as well. Through influential relatives, he received a series of promotions and served with the French Foreign Legion and the Army Information Service in Paris. Esterhazy was a pathological gambler and a pathological swindler as he attempted to settle his mounting debts. He married a countess from Lorraine for money, but his lifestyle constantly kept him on the verge of bankruptcy. He sold favors of every kind to any buyer. He even served as a second to a Jewish captain that was dueling with anti-Semitic journalists. And on the other hand, he coaxed money out of Baron Edmond de Rothschild. Espionage was not a surprising next step and a good source of income for a man of his kind. Dreyfus has already been in prison for nearly 2 years before Esterhazy's contacts with a German military attaché in Paris were discovered by the officer who had replaced Colonel Sander as chief of army intelligence. Lieutenant Colonel Georges Picard, Sander's replacement, was a very unlikely individual to play this role. An Alsatian Catholic who made no secret of his staunch anti-Semitism, he had taught Alfred Dreyfus at the École de Guerre. He was also present on that October morning in 1894 when he met the captain at the War Ministry and brought him to Dupaty, that meeting that started this whole affair. Picard had always been convinced of the prisoner's guilt. He also made sure to read all of Dreyfus's mail from Devil's Island and order all letters examined for invisible ink. While Picard shared many of his comrades' bigotry, he did not share the refusal to believe, in the face of real evidence, that anyone but Dreyfus could have written the bordereau, even though he was a Jew. Picard was a racist, a bigot and an anti-Semite. But he was not a fool, and he was not a coward. Early in 1896, he discovered a letter telegram addressed by the German attaché to Esterhazy. Proof that the French commandant was in league with the enemy. During the secret investigation that followed, Picard noted that Esterhazy's handwriting was identical to the one on the Dreyfus bordereau. And then he also learned the details of Esterhazy's biography and exploits. He informed his superiors of his belief that the wrong officer had been exiled, but he was ordered to stand down and not connect the Esterhazy investigation to the Dreyfus case. "What does it matter," said the deputy chief of staff, "if the Jew stays on Devil's Island?" Picard was then quickly transferred out of intelligence service and sent to a remote post in North Africa. Convinced that high-ranking officers had conspired to protect Esterhazy, Picard prepared a statement to be opened in the event of his death and shared his findings with his good friend and lawyer, Louis Leblois. Leblois passed this information under the strictest confidence to his Alsatian compatriot, Senator Sherrod Kessner. Only in the summer of 1897 did the senator confirm Esterhazy as a traitor to Mathieu. Later that year, when rumors started to spread in the Parisian press, Mathieu decided to formally and publicly condemn Esterhazy. Late on the night of November 15th, with legal advice from Demange and Leblois, Mathieu composed a letter of denunciation addressed to the Minister of War, General Jean-Baptiste Billot. The sole basis of the accusation brought in 1894 against my unfortunate brother is an unsigned, undated letter establishing that confidential military documents were delivered to an agent of a foreign military power. I have the honor of informing you that the author of that document is Monsieur le Comte Valzin Esterhazy. Confident that no panel of politicians or military judges would dare convict him, Esterhazy fought back and wrote the army's general investigator. "As an innocent man, the torture I have been enduring for 15 days is superhuman. As an officer accused of high treason, I have a right to the highest form of military justice. I await to be called before the court-martial of Paris." The general investigator that received this request not only had prior knowledge, but he also provided editorial assistance. The army naturally cooperated and scheduled the commandant's trial for January 10th, 1898. Mathieu was interviewed by officers in charge of the pre-trial inquiries. He immediately realized that Esterhazy's trial would be another farce. Not for a single instant did investigating officers search for the truth, Mathieu observed. Their goal was to portray Esterhazy as an innocent victim of a plot concocted by Picard with the complicity of the Dreyfus family. The army's so-called handwriting experts determined that Esterhazy had not written the bordereau. Instead, they now determined that the real traitor had attempted to implicate the commandant by mimicking his handwriting. Minutes after the court-martial convened in the same Cherche Midi annex where Dreyfus had been convicted 3 years before, the judges rejected the civil suits and confirmed their belief that Alfred Dreyfus had been lawfully convicted. With no opportunity to link Esterhazy to the bordereau, acquittal was certain. Officers and others in attendance interrupted Mathieu's testimony with howls and with laughter. After 2 days of testimony, a unanimous verdict of not guilty was reached by the judges, after only 3 minutes of deliberation. Mathieu had to push his way out through a menacing crowd of more than 1,000 gathered outside the courtroom and was besieged by the same shouts his brother had heard. Long live the army, long live France, death to the Jews. Esther Aziz's trial, although a farce, was a pivotal in turning Captain Alfred Dreyfus's court-martial into the Dreyfus affair. The case now moved from the courtroom to the arena of public opinion. Émile Zola, whose novels had examined social injustice in France for more than 2 decades, was at the peak of his controversial career. He was admired by radical critics of the status quo, but vilified by reactionary defenders of French morality. Rallying to Dreyfus, Zola could not help but mobilize and also divide public opinion. His first articles, published in Le Figaro prior to Esther Aziz's court-martial, analyzed the judicial errors committed since the captain's arrest. C'est scientifique, Zola said of the case, and he dissected its history with a blend of strict logic and high passion that distinguished his naturalist novels. But the first phase of Zola's involvement attracted only limited attention. On the morning of January 13, 1898, in response to the Esther Aziz verdict, Zola published an open letter to the President of the Republic. He had worked on the documents for 2 days and had brought a draft to the offices of L'Aurore newspaper on the night of January 12th. On the following morning, 300,000 copies of L'Aurore were sold on the streets of Paris and provincial cities of France with the bold headline, J'accuse. I accuse. Zola informed the public of the discoveries made by Picard and by Mathieu Dreyfus's private agents. The captain had been framed, and Esther Aziz had been aided and abetted by members of the general staff, and most especially by the criminal Commandant du Paty de Clam, a diabolical man with an extraordinary and demented imagination. Du Paty, Zola announced, is the entire Dreyfus affair. But the Commandant did not work alone, and Zola, fully aware that he was exposing himself to prosecution for libel, listed the co-conspirators. He accused General Mercier, Minister of War at the time of the captain's arrest, of having become an accomplice out of weakness of intellect, at least. He then accused General Billot, one of Mercier's successors, of having had in his hands certain proof of Dreyfus's innocence and having suppressed it. He accused Chief of Staff de Boisdeufel and Deputy Chief Charles Arthur Gons of being complicit in the same crime, one undoubtedly out of clerical passion, the other perhaps out of the esprit de corps which make the offices of war a wholly unassailable art. And he accused all the handwriting experts, army investigators, and military judges who had condemned Dreyfus and acquitted Esther Aziz. J'accuse brought with it a counterattack from the army, but also an explosion of violence. The Minister of War immediately brought suit against Zola and L'Aurore for libel. Sentenced to 1 year in prison and 3,000 francs fine, Zola filed a series of unsuccessful appeals and then fled to London to avoid imprisonment. The military high command dealt with Picard as well. They dismissed him from the army in February, and then he was subsequently imprisoned for exposing military secrets. Key Dreyfus supporters in the two houses of parliament were also dealt with. Sherrard Kestner was stripped of his Senate vice presidency. Many of the Dreyfus family's most effective supporters had been imprisoned, forced into exile, or chased from their positions of influence. Through January and February, riots erupted in Paris, provincial cities, and bloodiest of all, Algeria. Citizens set out to supposedly defend the army, turned on Jews, their homes, and their businesses. Students and demonstrators in Versailles, Reims, Lille, Nantes, Cannes, and other cities and towns attacked Jewish shops and synagogues while shouting kikes to the water, death to the Jews, down with Dreyfus, down with Zola, and long live the army. In Algeria, with its huge population of 50,000 Jews, distrusted by French settlers and detested by Arabs, crowds were fired up by Max Regis, a comrade of Drummond's and a future mayor of Algiers. Vigilantes assaulted Jews, sacked their bazaars, and pillaged their homes. Jewish families throughout France kept shutters bolted and doors locked. Then, a suicide of a French officer signaled perhaps the most important turning point of the affair. Missing from Zola's list of Dupaty's accomplices was an officer who testified for the prosecution during the 1894 court-martial. Commandant Henry, a later head of the Intelligence Bureau, had announced during the trial that the Tat-Major had proof of Dreyfus's treachery, but that matters of national security prevented him from disclosing it. He swore on his honor. But Henry, as it turned out, had kept more than his share of secrets under his kepi. Along with Dupaty, he had protected Esterhazy. And to ensure that the Dreyfus dossier contained sufficient proof of guilt, he engaged in full-scale forgery. He forged that letter in 1896 from the Italian military attaché in Paris to his German counterpart, that mentioned, and I quote, relations with this Jew Dreyfus. But on a review of that file a few months later, an officer noticed that the letter was an obvious forgery. The Minister of War, Godefroy Cavaignac, confronted Henri and he confessed, suggesting that an overzealous commitment to preserving the honor of the military had prompted his patriotic mistake. Sent to the prison fortress of Mont-Valérin, Henry was found 24 hours later with his jugular cut, shaving razor in his hand, and the stench of rum permeating his cell. Army Chief of Staff de Boisdeufre resigned that day. Cavaignac a few days later, and within 2 weeks, Dupaty had been retired. In late September, Esterhazy, who had fled to London, confessed that he had written the bordereau, not as a spy, but under orders from Colonel Sander, head of army intelligence. It was a convenient scenario, since Sander died of natural causes in 1897. So I guess we'll never know. It was all unraveling. Hopes were running high in the early days of 1899, but the military was still blocking the prisoner's return. Picard, now the most celebrated figure of the affair, remained in prison, still accused of espionage. President Félix Faure was unwilling to challenge the military and risk greater social unrest. But then, on the evening of February 16, 1899, the president died of a cerebral hemorrhage in a back bedroom of the presidential suite in the arms of his mistress. France now gained a new president with a reputation for managing scandals and with a sense of moderation that had been lacking in nearly every government leader over the past 4 years. Loubet had the right credentials to extricate the Republic from an affair that had gone on far too long. The case had become a national and international scandal. The Dreyfus affair needed a political solution, and quickly. The United Courts of Appeal, after another period of political maneuvers and legal inquiries, set aside the 1894 condemnation and referred the case to a new court-martial in the provincial city of Rennes. Later, sometime during all of his prison tutorials, in his prison cell, Alfred Dreyfus received a letter from Emile Zola. "If I have not been one of the first to send you all my sympathy, all my affection, upon your return to France, it is because I feared that my letter would be incomprehensible. I wanted to wait until your admirable brother had seen you and told you of our long combat. At this hour, your great task is to bring us justice, to finally calm our poor and noble country. The honor of the army that you will save, this army that you have loved so much, in which you have placed all your idealism, it is we who are its true defenders." The day was approaching, Zola promised Dreyfus, when the army would be not only a manifestation of power, but of justice. Rennes was a large enough city to easily accommodate the mass of journalists, officers, and functionaries expected for Dreyfus's retrial. A good number of town dwellers were on holiday, by the sea or in the countryside, leaving the city mostly deserted. That, combined with a sweltering summer heat, was ideal to minimize the drama of Captain Alfred Dreyfus's second court-martial. Visitors began arriving in late June and early July from Paris and the rest of the country. In addition, hundreds of newspaper journalists, correspondents, photographers, political caricaturists, legal experts, and assorted curiosity seekers traveled from America, Great Britain, and every other major European city. Police declared a restricted zone and cordoned off the area surrounding the military prison, the house rented by the Dreyfus family, and a few hundred meters away, the high school chosen as a site for the court-martial. Lucy traveled a short distance to the prison in a closed carriage surrounded by police guards, ordered to remove Madame Dreyfus from public curiosity. Mathieu Dreyfus was pursued by journalists in Rennes with no less diligence than they had in Paris. Those same journalists who convicted Alfred Dreyfus before the fact condemned the prisoner's brother, the crafty Jew, responsible for the Jewish syndicate campaign. French police assigned detectives to protect Mathieu, as they had done for Lucy. Due to the hostile attitude of many police agents, however, the family mobilized its own private contingents of bodyguards, led by 26-year-old Alfred's nephew, Paul. The son of Alfred's sister came to the job with experience. Paul took upon himself to protect Mathieu during the months of the affair. He too was ex-military. A veteran of the French cavalry, he even served as a bodyguard to Queen Victoria during a winter holiday in Nice. The members of the Dreyfus family were no joke. All military men, successful industrialists, literally salt of the earth. Anyway, the greatest challenge for the forces of law and order would be to get Alfred Dreyfus through the trial alive. Rumors of assassination plots, created the need for nearly 200 mounted police, along with other troops, to secure the city's restricted zone and additional agents to secure other parts of the city. Posters calling for calm were hung up all over the city, and many feared that the sleepy provincial town might awaken on the first days of the trial to the worst violence it had known since the French Revolution. Subsidized anti-Semitic demonstrators from Paris were flowing into the city. They were tempted with free wine, a few francs, and the promise of a good time. Activists responsible for the recent pogroms in Algeria were also on their way. As the trial approached, a wave of inflammatory articles and caricatures appeared in the provincial and Parisian press. To avoid the midsummer heat, the trial would begin early, at 6 a.m. Alfred Dreyfus was escorted to a side entrance of the high school. Armed guards flanked the captain, and inside the school's iron gate, a double line of soldiers turned their backs on him as a sign of dishonor. Nearby, mounted patrols galloped along the avenues with sabers rattling, and policemen with rifles and revolvers kept watch throughout the area. Special agents combed the school's basement in search of bombs, and clerks stationed at the public entrance on the north side collected all canes and umbrellas. By the time the court convened, no incidents had been reported, and the anxiety over street riots had given way to the anticipation of Dreyfus's entrance into the school's auditorium. A long table for the seven military judges filled the stage. Immediately below, former cabinet ministers, generals, and other high-ranking officers sat in red velvet armchairs. Less notable witnesses filled benches further back. A spectator section was located at the extreme rear, and armed guards lined the room's periphery. Reporters worked at banks of tables running along the southern bay of high windows. 400 journalists held press passes. Directly across from them, on another raised platform, the Mansion Laborie in full black robes with long white collars prepared for the opening session. A simple straight chair, placed in front of the defense table for Captain Dreyfus, provided a striking contrast to the plush furniture set out for his chief of accusers. Only his family, lawyers, and prison officials had seen Captain Dreyfus since his return from Devil's Island. The rest of the audience waited in anticipation to see if what they imagined of the prisoner would match reality. Mathieu took his place at the back of the hall. Unable to watch his brother's first contact with humanity in 5 years, he closed his eyes when Alfred was summoned. In a new artillery officer's uniform with gold braid, buttons, new boots, spurs, cap, white gloves, and sword, Dreyfus entered through a north door behind the defense table. He marched at the brisk, soldierly pace. "He's a little old man," wrote a correspondent from the London Times. "A little old man of 39. Another journalist commented that he was, and I quote, "like a phantom who had the best of years of his life taken away from him and who had returned from hell." With his semi-paralyzed throat and missing teeth, Alfred only managed to emit hoarse, mostly inaudible sounds. And his sentences were cut short by his lack of breath and stamina. Some of the listeners compared the sound to recent inventions. "Dreyfus spoke like a phonograph," said one witness. His voice seemed to be coming from a distant place, said another. Heard through static, like a voice transmitted by telephone. Many of the witnesses of the second court-martial had also appeared at the 1894 court-martial and at the trials of Esterhazy, Zola, and Picard. They have become known as the personnel of the affair. How many ruins and wrecks there were among them, stated one writer. All those whom the Dreyfus case has morally killed were there. It was like a necropolis, said another. Mathieu Dreyfus had the same impression. Is there nothing under these uniforms, all embroidered in gold? Neither heart nor conscience? Across the 5 weeks of the trial, the prosecution would call 70 witnesses, the defense only 20. And through it all, the judges allowed the prosecutor and his witnesses to digress, to intervene, and to comment at will. Statements by the defense were frequently cut short. But Dreyfus, fighting for his life, believed that the truth was all that mattered. But his fight was not only in the courtroom. He was suffering from malarial fever, and he continued to lose weight. Guards noted that he had hardly touched his food. He suffered chills and wore layers of heavy clothing in the middle of the scorching summer. He was also not getting enough sleep, as he was jolted awake by nightmares of his stay on Devil's Island. His exile also led to an addiction to stimulants that he took every morning. Alfred Dreyfus was on the brink of physical and emotional collapse. All he could do was hope that a decision was near. On the morning of August 14th, the monotony of the trial ended when his lawyer, Fernand Laborie, failed to appear in the courtroom. He was shot in the back near one of the bridges on his way to the high school. Semi-paralyzed, he was forced to roll over on his briefcase in order to prevent passers-by from stealing his trial documents. Till finally the police arrived. It takes more than a bullet from a revolver to kill me, Laborie told Mathieu shortly after the assault. It takes a cannonball. 8 days later, he would be back at the defense table. Demange gave a meticulous presentation of the physical evidence and above all, to the question of the bordereau. He addressed the honorable witnesses and loyal judges, and then added a final compliment. I have confidence in you, he told the court, because you are soldiers. Dreyfus had held to the memory of his summer meeting with Boisdeffre in 1894. Walking along the banks of the Moselle River, the then young captain had impressed the chief of staff and had come away convinced of the general's goodwill. Even though his lawyers and brother exposed Boisdeffre's complicity, Dreyfus clung to the hope that his superior had not joined the ranks of his accusers. But he did. For the final session, police barricades outside the courtroom were quadrupled. At the close of the session, the court asked for Captain Dreyfus's final statement. Before my country and the army, I affirm that I am innocent. For 5 years, I have undergone the most frightening torture for the unique goal of saving my name and the name of my children. Today, I am convinced that I have attained that goal because of your loyalty and your sense of justice. The court adjourned. Guards led the prisoner to a nearby room to await the verdict. At 4:45 on the afternoon of September 9th, after an hour of deliberation, the military judges found Captain Alfred Dreyfus guilty of the crime of high treason. Demange broke down on hearing the verdict. Alfred Dreyfus said simply, "Console my wife." For the hundreds of demonstrators gathered outside the Paris offices of La Libre Parole, the night of the verdict marked a moment of jubilation. For nearly 6 hours, crowds paraded through the city shouting, "Long live Drummond! Long live the army! Death to the Jews!" And ended the night singing the Marseillaise. On the other side of the country, demonstrators celebrated with identical slogans while they smashed the windows of Jacques Dreyfus's home. The police, after dispersing the crowd, had to stand guard all night. According to the letter of the law, Dreyfus was now facing perpetual deportation and imprisonment in a fortified locale. And after another public degradation, I returned to Devil's Island. But the verdict came with a qualification that angered the captain's friends and enemies alike. The judges announced that extenuating circumstances prevailed in the case. Politics had informed their verdict, and politics would determine a traitor's punishment. The judges tried to appease both camps. Dreyfus was sentenced to only 10 years detention and given credit for the 5 years he had already served. When Mathieu asked him to renew his strength in order to continue the battle and possibly confront another degradation, Alfred reacted with sudden anger and shouted, "I will not undergo a new degradation. I will not wear my uniform again so that I could be defiled a second time." Dreyfus signed a formal appeal 3 hours after the verdict. But an appeal would take time. And after two convictions, a favorable decision would require a miracle. Mathieu did not think his brother would live 6 months if he remained in prison. The only other option was a presidential pardon, and it would require political maneuvering in the quarters of Parliament and the Élysée. Mathieu knew that Alfred aimed for complete recognition of his innocence and for the rehabilitation of his family name. A pardon offered within 48 hours, he believed, would serve as a clear rejection of the army's judgment and would save Dreyfus's life. The French president wanted an end to this political chaos, and his prime minister, René Valdec-Cousson, considered Demange among his closest friends. Mathieu would ask the prime minister to secure a presidential pardon, and he would receive it. In the arena of public opinion, a pardon would be looked on as a solution, as an end to the affair. During the final days of the court-martial, as one police agent had reported, the forces of order thought less of Dreyfus in Rennes than of Paris in full revolt. Anti-Semites and militant nationalists confronted socialists and anarchists, with each group invading the other's political rallies, and with violence and injuries reported among demonstrators and police. From Esterhazy's trial and the riots that followed, J'accuse, to the charade of Dreyfus's reconviction with extenuating circumstances, foreign reactions to the French political, judicial, and military systems had gone from bad to worse. Confidential reports submitted to the Minister of Foreign Affairs from French embassies and consulates throughout Europe and America had confirmed the sad impression the affair was making overseas. The entire press of the United States, even the most moderate newspapers, said one diplomat, attacked the government in France with extreme violence and conspicuous bad faith. From Rome, Vienna, and Madrid came other reports chronicling unfavorable impressions and outright hostility. German newspapers in Berlin and Cologne lashed out at the government's handling of the affair in editorials that were hateful in temperament and violent. But so too did the Dutch, who called it, and I quote, the greatest scandal of the century. French-descended Huguenots wrote from the newspaper's headquarters in Springfield, Massachusetts, to protest the fanaticism and intolerance rampant in France. According to the French embassy in London, every British newspaper expressed its hostility toward France and its support for the prisoner. Mathieu also received an assessment from a Mulhouse industrialist. Here, as in Switzerland and beyond, people are asking if France has gone mad. French diplomats in the field and specialists in Paris attempted to explain away those reactions as the inspiration of foreign Jews out to humiliate France. Many of the large newspapers are in the hands of the Jews, went one report from the French embassy in London. When demonstrators in Brussels criticized French handling of the affair, their comments were considered understandable in a city, quote, which has been one of the most active theaters of operations for the Israelite syndicate, end quote. Every form of bigotry and racism appeared in French assessments of foreign reactions to the affair. The principal worry remained the Jews, and nowhere were they more powerful, French perceptions had it, than in Central Europe. Austrian newspapers were bound to attack the army and support Dreyfus, observers insisted, since those papers were, and I quote, almost entirely in the hands of the Jews. In the final years of the century, anti-Semitism in France had also reached and infected the French diplomatic corps, as it did the majority of the high command. But in late summer and fall of 1899, the problem of foreign reactions would not go away. And when even Queen Victoria expressed her displeasure with the affair, the international repercussions were clear. The British Lord Chief Justice had witnessed the court-martial, and the Queen announced her profound sorrow on hearing the news of the verdict and declared Dreyfus's condemnation to be, and I quote, in defiance of good sense. The British ambassador in Paris believed that no impartial foreigner could contemplate the case without a sensation of pity, very much allied to contempt. And he admitted to his own feelings of mental nausea. The London Times had also shown its anger. It had no hesitation in affirming that the sentence constitutes in itself the grossest and most appalling prostitution of justice which the world has witnessed in modern times. The paper concluded with an attack on France's most cherished image. Never before, in a country which claims to march at the head of civilization, so flagrantly, so deliberately, so mercilessly trampled justice, honor, and truth underfoot. But rhetoric aside, the affair also started having economic implications for France. The organizers of the 19, 100 Paris Universal Exposition aimed to draw even more visitors than the 32 million who in 1889 had marveled at the Eiffel Tower. In 1889, visitors had left behind a surplus of 8 million francs. And 1900 was supposed to bring in even greater profits. But Switzerland would now refuse any participation in the exposition. And the same debate was now taking place in German industrial circles. Foreign commission agents have been ordered by their enterprises to purchase no fashion articles in France, reported the director of the Galerie Lamartin department store in Paris. Witnesses in Vienna, Budapest, Brussels, Rome, Milan, and Naples confirmed more threats of a boycott. French agents in Britain predicted the failure of the exposition. Those were the pressures that influenced Loubet's decision to pardon Dreyfus. French grandeur would be best served if the government acted on the ideals of the revolution, ideals they were about to package for commercial consumption at a world's fair. A pardon would be secured, but given a legal technicality, the prisoner would have to first withdraw his appeal. Mathieu had to return from Paris and present the option to his brother. If he accepted, he could be free the following day. Mathieu boarded the night train for Rennes at the Gare Saint-Lazare. He carried a letter from Minister of War Gaston de Galifier to the director of the military prison, which would enable him to meet his brother in private. At 6 a.m. on September 12th, Mathieu and Alfred were alone for the first time in over 5 years. Describing the events of the past 2 days, Mathieu tried to convince his brother. "I was resolutely hostile to the idea at the beginning," Alfred Dreyfus would later write. "I had a thirst only for justice." But Mathieu explained that a pardon would have a considerable impact as a condemnation of the army's verdict. And he reminded Alfred of his duty to his wife, to his children, and to his family. It took 2 hours, but at the end of it, Alfred finally agreed to accept the pardon and bring the 5 years of his physical and moral torture to an end. Under pressure from his newly formed government, the president agreed to sign the pardon as a humanitarian gesture on the condition that medical reasons could be documented. Mathieu returned to Paris yet again and then had to travel back to Rennes with a physician, Dr. Delbet, the only official visitor Alfred would later note to show any sign of human sympathy. The physician's report left no doubt. Dreyfus was completely physically exhausted and, along with malnutrition and malarial fever, showed symptoms of tuberculosis of the spinal marrow. If he were not freed immediately, the medical report concluded, his health would deteriorate and he would be dead within months. On September 19th, 1899, the President of the Republic signed a pardon that annulled Alfred Dreyfus' 10-year sentence and cancelled his second military degradation. Mathieu arranged for a statement from the captain to be published immediately. "The government of the Republic grants me my freedom. It is nothing to me without my honor. Beginning today, I shall persist in working towards a reparation of the frightful judicial error whose victim I continue to be. I want all of France to know, through a definite judgment, that I am innocent. My heart will be at rest only when there is not a single Frenchman who imputes to me the crime committed by another. Well, I guess this is as good a spot as any to stop for now. In the next episode, we'll wrap it all up and discuss the end of the affair and its aftermath for Dreyfus and his family. Again, most of the research is from the great book by Michael Burns, Dreyfus, A Family Affair. There will be a link in the show notes, or you can simply visit theisraelpodcast.com/episode008. Thanks for listening and checking out the Israel Podcast. I hope you tune in next time for the final Dreyfus episode.